Hello, welcome to another edition of Thinking Like a Lawyer. I'm Joe Patrice from Above the Law. I'm joined by my colleague Chris Williams, and we're going to be going through some of the big stories of the legal week that was, as usual. But first, we always begin, you know, by not jumping into anything too quickly. We by having a little bit of our small talk with all the necessary fanfare. How you doing over there?
Doing pretty good. Pretty good.
Good.
Enjoying the weather.
Oh, yeah? How warm is it there?
Honestly, it's like, I feel like it's like 80 or so, 80, 90.
Okay. Yeah. It's warmer than it is here.
Yeah, with the sun down.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah.
That's what it's like to be closer to the tropics. Or in the tropics, even, are you? I'm not good with my geography off the top of my head.
Yeah, I default law rather than geography as well.
Fair. So there's not much happening, small talk wise from my perspective. I guess I will flag this. This is not one of the stories we're talking about this week, but it's worth just flagging to let people know that we did see it, that Allen and Overy, who has tried and failed to merge with an American firm before, not failed. It's not, I don't want to make it sound like a failure, but like they've tried and it's not worked out in the past. Sherman and Sterling, who has been trying and failing to merge with a international firm for a while. Well, it works out. They're going to get together. You know, these crazy kids are going to make a go of it. So A&O Sherman, we wish them all the best in their future endeavors. I don't know where they're registered, but send them a little wedding gift. But that's about all that I have on the breaking news front. This just kind of happened as we were getting set to record, so we don't really have any deep thoughts about it, but wanted to make sure, since you're going to hear this a little later, that it doesn't sound like we completely missed a major merger or anything like that. Well, with that said, unless there's anything else we want to talk about that is small, we can start big talk.
Yeah, I feel like medium to larger talk would be appropriate.
All right, so we're going to transition to medium talk. Okay, so...
So World War III. No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so far, who knows by the time they listen to this. But for now, we're going to talk a little bit of... this is a story that I wrote last week that generated a lot of conversation that made me think it might be worth a deeper dive. So Kamala Harris is, once again, now some of these comments aren't even comments she recently made, but they are being floated around on the social medias and the mainstream medias, which usually is a sign that someone in a politician's office is floating a test balloon about various kinds of rhetoric to see how it might play with the public. And there was a little burst of folks who were passing it around virally about how Harris has started saying some stuff about public defenders and the criminal justice system, and it was getting a lot of good play. If she talked tough on crime like this, we would have voted for her in the primaries last time. A lot of that sort of rhetoric going around. And it struck me from working at a legal blog as really problematic that she is once again kind of leaning into and circulating this sort of rhetoric and allowing this conversation to be how she is defined. The way in which this went down was she put out this discussion that as a prosecutor, she would go after all of these people in predominantly black neighborhoods. And she said public defenders, she specifically decides to bash public defenders, would put black people on the jury because they thought those jurors would be sympathetic. But I knew better because I knew that Black jurors don't want crime in their neighborhood, and the public defender would always be shocked that they would end up losing, which I assume, I mean, well, I guess, first of all, let's take that apart. So, Chris, we talked about this a little bit. So what's your take here, at least? There's a lot to break down.
Well, before we even get to this, I've just always been suspicious of Kamala's prosecutorial decisions once it got out that, like, she was smoking weed herself and still putting people behind bars for it. I've just been generally suspicious of her choices. Then again, you know, that's what you get when you have a top cop as the vice president.
There's a lot here. I would say the one that I feel the most troubled by is, I feel as though, and of course prosecutors often, you know, you get deeply involved in that job, you take on that mentality, but I feel like she knows better. And I feel like she's being deliberately obtuse here. She knows that that's not why public defenders prefer having black jurors in cases with black defendants, because it's not as though a criminal trial involves the defense attorney turning to the jury and saying, I mean, my client. I mean, my client did it, but you don't care about that, right? Like, that's absurd. No one does that. That's not at all what a criminal trial is about. And she knows that. What is a criminal trial about? Criminal trial is about that public defender is going to say, yeah, this is a very serious crime, and my guy didn't do it. My guy was picked up by cops who didn't care enough to investigate and find out who really did it. He's been railroaded through the system. He's been prosecuted by an overzealous prosecutor who doesn't have any interest in getting to the bottom to this, just with closing her stats as quickly as possible. That's what a defense is. And the argument is that more so than white suburban jurors, it's marginally more possible that a black juror will understand that that could happen.
Well, yeah. My thing with Kamala, and for me, when this really stuck out back when there was like the presidential debates going on, she's really good with optics. Like, I remember there was a point where somebody asked, basically, what would happen if Donald Trump doesn't respect the results of the election? And I think her response was like a deadpan, well, we'll see what happens, rather than being like, that's treason or something, or like the rule of law will kick in. Like, I think that she understands that there are social consequences that can be, you know, leveraged. And I think this is one of those things where, at least in the public imaginary, I feel like there's an assumption that black people are always biased. They can't see race neutrally, you know, in a way that is assumed that white folks can, like, you know, choose to not see race. And I don't know, maybe this made more sense with whatever audience she was trying to appeal to as far as her, you know, get up and do it ness, or like ability to win hard cases. Maybe it felt like I don't even have to lean on the black jurors to get the job done, you know?
Yeah. You know, I actually, let's focus on that, because that was one thing I got a lot of pushback from on social media about this. And some folks were saying, you know, it is a long held racial stereotype that black people don't care about crime, which is theoretically what Harris is trying to say she doesn't agree with. But my take was, I think she's almost saying the opposite. It's that very subtle, like, oh, you know, everybody's crazy except you people, where she's trying to make the statement by implying that she's talking to the exception, not the rule. And given that we actually have statistical data showing that black and African-American jurors tend to acquit slightly more, but statistically significantly more than white jurors, because, you know, largely because they ask questions about the, you know, about the defense and how it's being structured, and do see the possibility that somebody might be railroaded by a system. Given that that actually happens, when she says, oh, I know that's not how things work, it's a rhetorical device that actually reinforces that trope by claiming the opposite of it is her own experience.
It's one of those things where it's like sometimes you look at a thing and this and your gut reaction is, you know, the person saying this ought to be smart enough to where they know that this isn't anchored in truth. What are the benefits of them saying this thing as the thing that's being deployed? And I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe she's trying to reach out to voters that wouldn't necessarily. I think she's trying to reach into the tough on crime crowd and, you know, trying to middle road it. I don't even think this is anything about what's happening in front of us.
What gets me about that is the tough on crime crowd. Like, there are ways to sell yourself as a prosecutor right now. Like, you could sell yourself by, you know, I busted child molesters. I busted big companies who were poisoning people. I took guns off the street. These are ways in which a prosecutor could really juice their role vis-a-vis the electorate. And she seems historically to have been uninterested in those angles of the job of prosecutor and more interested in the ones that don't necessarily resonate with voters that she has any chance of getting.
Hey man, I'm not saying it's a good move. I'm just saying it looks like a move to me.
Oh no, I agree. But anyway, this was an interesting legal question for, I thought, because when you're the ways in which we talk about the criminal justice system kind of matter, especially when it's being framed at the highest levels. And putting aside whether or not her story's true or not, the way in which we have a major government official talking about public defenders as though they are stupid, as though they have these implicit racist assumptions about folks that you shouldn't trust as a juror what the defendants, what the defense attorney is trying to say. Those struck me as real tangible ways in which the justice system is getting a little eroded just by the way in which and the rhetoric that we choose. And that, I thought, more so than anything else about it, bugged me as a legal matter, because at a time when the rule of law is a little precarious all over the place, it's not really helpful to be saying, you know, public defenders are crazy people out there who don't know any better and you should ignore them, you know.
Yeah. And what do you know? You're not vice president. You know?
I mean, maybe when you get to that point. Generate quality briefs, memos, and redlines in minutes with Calidus AI. You enter the case's facts, then Calidus suggests bodies of law, statutes, and precedents. You tell it if those are relevant, and Calidus generates a well-cited, well-formatted document. You can trust what went into it because you put it there. Be exceptionally productive with better outcomes using Legal's most advanced AI platform. Just 3 minutes from registration to results. Get $90 off your first 2 months. Use promo code Joe at CalidusAI.com. That's CalidusAI.com.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there?
Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
Order up.
There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Gee, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Gee and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network, available wherever podcasts are found.
So the next thing we wanted to talk about, this is actually a couple of stories. Maybe we need to have a sound effect for this. I don't even know what it would be, but this is kind of our Ron DeSantis watch, because a couple of things came up. Now, we've talked about him in the context of his Disney travails before. A new one cropped up. It turns out that this is basic Civ Pro for anybody out there who's, you know, trying to think, scratching their head back to first year of law school. This was a basic civil procedure question. Whole deal with the Disney board where DeSantis passed the rule to change all the board members, the old board signed valid agreements, turning about all of that power back over to Disney. They're now trying to reverse that. The new board filed a lawsuit in state court trying to reverse that. Meanwhile, the DeSantis administration and the Republican supermajority legislature decided to pass a law mooting those contracts, which meant that in the state court where they want to be, because they do not want to be removed to the federal court case that they have, Disney's lawyers just walked in and said, but given that law exists, you don't have any standing anymore. Like, this case is moot. It's already gone. There's no contract for you to claim as being injured. It's just wild. Like, all they had to do, Chris, was just do nothing. They could have done nothing, and the board could have sued. And they could have been in state court like they wanted.
You see, this is why people need to watch Avatar The Last Airbender.
Okay.
You know, it
interesting has direction.
It has real-world consequences. Have you seen the show?
I am aware of it. I have not seen it.
Oh,
so,
you're missing out.
So explain to me, because I'm interested in this, so now how does that help you on Cipro?
I am happy. So okay. For anybody who's watched the show and is more cultured than Joe, listen, I'm going to make my case. There's a scene where King Boomy is locked up in a steel cage, and he knows that come nightfall, his enemies are going to be very strong. And the day after, they become normal strength. So his allies are like, what do we do? He's like, just wait. Just wait until the siege is done. And then after that, well, let me clarify. There's a night where they're very strong. And then the day they lose their power. He's like, just wait until the siege is done. And in the daytime, Glenn, you literally just have to do nothing. Just wait. And it's called negative Jing. It's a thing in strategy. You figure out sometimes the best movement is no movement, you know, war games. Sometimes the best game is to not play, like that sort of thing.
Wow. There's an old reference. Totally.
I know my audience.
All right. Nice, nice, nice. So some old school 80s movie references. All right. So, but yes, no, that is exactly what I was thinking when I read this, was that all they needed to do is not pass a law, and the board could have challenged this. Now, put aside whether or not the board had any hope of winning it, they could have been there. And the mere fact that they passed the bill means that the state courts are now largely closed off to them, which is a problem if you, like DeSantis, his lawyers have already argued, believe that the federal court is biased against you. So if your concern is the federal court's a problem, you're the problem. It's you, to make some Taylor references.
Ooh.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're pulling out all the stops on pop culture. Okay.
I respect it. I don't like it. I respect it.
Fair enough. So what else has Ron been up to this week? He's been having other fights with the Constitution.
Yeah. Specifically the 14th Amendment. So
it's a good one. It's one of my favorites. Messy. Yeah.
It's a little messy, but apparently it's not good enough for DeSantis. So there was a bill that came to his desk, and it was a law basically allows children to be seized from trans parents. Again, that's not invisible people, just parents that are trans, you know.
Right. No, got it. Yeah, that's a good one.
Just to be clear, you know. But yeah, so like it says, like, if the children are subject to or are threatened with being
Hold on. You said just to be clear. So you're fine. You are not opaque in any way.
That was a triple down.
All right, go.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, back to abduction. So there's a law saying if the children are subjected to or are threatened with being subjected to, whatever the hell that means, gender affirming care, like say puberty blockers or hormone replacement therapy, they can be seized. But like, how do you know if a person is threatened with being subjected to that? Like, do you look at their TikTok formulas and determine like what they're being, anyway? It's one of those things where the biggest thing here is not the vagueness, but the fact that it's just violating the, you know, the due process. Well, no, not due process.
Well, both, probably.
Well, also be a problem. The due process, but also
equal protection, definitely.
There we go. Yeah. Sometimes my mind blanks. There was a similar case, and court decided that no person should be denied access to medical care just because of their transgender status. And this law spits in the face of that.
Well, so obviously you have an equal protection issue because you're treating folks differently based on stuff. Now, whatever form of scrutiny these courts decide to give it, probably not strict, but whatever. So you've got that. But I mean, I think you raised the due process point, and I think that one's also there because basically anytime you deal with child protective services style seizures, it mm-hmm. strikes me as though that it's real precarious where it sits on the due process bounds, right? Like we have a presumption that people get to parent their kids. So it requires a lot. Yeah.
Speaking of precarity, it's Florida. It's a fucking stand your ground state. You think somebody is not going to get shot trying to take somebody's kid?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. And don't worry. The stand your ground is kind of arbitrarily applied. It really yeah, isn't yeah. going to apply when the government's trying to take somebody, but yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but it's true. Like, because it doesn't matter whether or not it really applies, right? It matters if people think it does.
If they think it does.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if I think I have the right to shoot somebody, it doesn't matter.
And you
matter
know
if
somebody's coming in to seize your
yeah,
kid.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if I'm going to lose on the back end. Mm. I'm going to feel I'm emboldened to take the action on the front end. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, I haven't experienced this firsthand, but I get the feeling that trans bullets feel the same as cis ones.
I was trying to see if there was another way to make a opaque, transparent joke there, but not.
Were you having were you having gender trouble?
No, it was more trying to quadruple down on that distinction.
No, that was a Judith Butler reference.
Well done.
Yeah.
My brain is definitely not switched on to the recognizing Judith Butler references while I'm doing this show. So you got me. All right. Yeah. So it's another trip to federal court inevitably for this administration. Don't worry. The taxpayers of the state will be picking up the tab again. Okay. So the Supreme Court is a place.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. And it's a place where we usually talk about how collegial thing, or historically we talk about how collegial it is. Lately we have not been talking about how collegial it is, but at least we've been talking about the collegiality divide being along somewhat political lines. That's not the case this week. Yeah, no, we had a completely nonpartisan question about intellectual property, and it was a 7-2 decision, and Kagan wrote for the dissent and got a little salty towards Justice Sotomayor.
It was well seasoned.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just read a bit of this footnote. Now, it's fair to say that Justice Sotomayor did pointedly refer to things in the dissent as part of the majority opinion and would say, you know, the dissent makes this argument, but doesn't really explain why this would be true, which is why we in the majority decide XYZ. So there's a bit of a call out happening, but it's a call out happening to address issues in the dissent. It's not really personal. It doesn't, at least it didn't seem to me. That brings us to Justice Kagan, who opens her opinion with a footnote. Because you know things are off the rails when it's in a footnote, right? Like that's the footnote is a powerful way to earmark that you're gonna write a diss track. So it begins. One preliminary note before beginning in earnest. As readers are by now aware, the majority opinion is trained on this dissent in a way majority opinions seldom are. Maybe that makes the majority opinion self-refuting. After all, a dissent with no theory and no reason is not usually thought to merit pages of commentary and fistfuls of comeback footnotes. In any event, I'll not attempt to rebut point for point the majority's varied accusations. Instead, I'll mainly rest on my original submission. I'll just make two suggestions about reading what follows. First, when you see that my description of a precedent differs from the majority's, go take a look at the decision. Second, when you come across an argument that you recall the majority took issue with, go back to its response and ask yourself, about the ratio of reasoning to Ipsy Dixit. With those two recommendations, I'll take my chances on the reader's good judgment.
And for those not as fluent in Latin, Ipsy Dixit
is like an unproven statement.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But
which is
yeah.
completely different from Dixie Cups.
It sort of. But yes, I mean, I'm wondering, is it? I mean, I don't know if they're really cups. Anyway, point is, no, I shouldn't do that. They could be a sponsor someday. Who knows? Anyway, but yeah, no. This is mean and snippy for people who have to, you know, work together tomorrow.
I think it's an olive branch to, I don't know, like 1L's 2 or 3 years from not have to read through cases. The professor will be like, hey, look at this. Look.
Okay, so you're taking the stance that they're just trying to keep it interesting. It's like a wrestling script. You know, you got to have a little bit of drama in here.
Yeah, you know, I mean, their legitimacy is on the rocks anyway. I mean, they got to do something to keep people interested.
Yeah. Well, let's talk real quick about the substance of this case, because I thought the substance of the case was interesting, too. So
I really liked that. There was one point where I think like the tension was like just because they were like, you're not getting the artistic merit of Andy Warhol. And they're like, just because it's a famous person doesn't mean that they get to do that. And I'm reading it and I'm like, I don't know. I kind of get it because did you see the picture?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when I saw the picture, it wasn't just. This is a picture of Prince. My thought was, this is an Andy Warhol of Prince.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is some wiggle room where like a person's stature or like popularity or the uniqueness of their art that they do in the field changes the nature of the thing.
Yeah. So
like
so
there are Basquiats. There would be a Basquiat. There could be a Basquiat Andy Warhol, you know, like. Their name is more than just the person that did it. It refers to their stature and art and things that contribute to the aesthetic understanding of it.
Yeah. So take a step back. There was a photograph taken by a photographer of Prince years ago. It was licensed to a magazine for a one-time use, and the magazine said, we're going to bring in an artist to take your photo and make it into kind of an illustration. And they brought in Andy Warhol, and Andy Warhol made it purple, which makes sense.
As one should.
Yeah, and they used it, and that was fine. Years later, Prince has died, and another publication is looking to put this picture back up and reaches out to the Andy Warhol Foundation. And Andy Warhol Foundation's like, you know, he actually did a bunch of these. He like ended up making them all different colors and they ended up using the orange one. And the original photographer is like, what the hell, man? Like I took this picture. I licensed it to be turned into an art piece once. You don't get to profit off my picture anymore. And you know, the fair use argument is, hey, this is transformative. This is now a Warhol, which Warhol's whole thing is this kind of pop art work where that makes sense. And like you said, you look at it and you can say, oh, well, Warhol must have done this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the problem is, at a certain point, how much does that become? He's one of the most famous people in the world, so he throws a prototype of an Instagram filter on somebody else's photo and sells it as his. Is that really fair and transformative? And I don't necessarily think the majority opinion is the best way of describing where the line is in fair use, but I kind of sympathize with Sotomayor that the dissent basically has no line. The dissent's version of things more or less boils down to, look, if somebody who says they're an artist ever touches it, then it becomes their work. And that seems like that would be a real slippery slope real fast, you know? It was an interesting case.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, there are a couple people that consider themselves artists that should be working for Dixie Cup. I don't know if they should be the okay. ones that get the right to be able to copy and reproduce however their heart sees fit. But there's a thing that happens in art, man. Like there's this one of my favorite paintings. I feel like it's a transformative work. I think it's by Francis Bacon. It's like study Astor Velazquez. I think it's a rendition of this portrait of Pope Innocent. And the way he did it, it was like had like this ghastly, ephemeral, like you ever see like in the Harry Potter movies when like a Dementor is sucking the soul out of somebody?
Yeah.
Have that kind of like that shadowy wispiness to it. And it's a beautiful thing. And when you look at it, it's like, I know what this is from, but this is different. Or like there are some musical samples where I'm like, I know that this is from I'm in heaven.
Okay.
Tom Club. You know what it is?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like let's not have you sing if possible.
Well, I'm not the artist doing the transformation, but you get it. There are some musical samples where you hear him, you're like, how did you do this? Like when Jay Dilla flipped Erykah Badu's Didn't You Know, like made that was phenomenal. Like there are just some works of artistry and it's hard to deny them, but it's like, I see what you did with the source materials, but this is something different.
Right. And, you know, but even especially in music, when you do that, when you take somebody's work and transform it, you know, you end up getting a credit usually on that mm-hmm. piece. And that's the thing that's not happening here, which is potentially problematic. But it's true. And I know that because I was going to make some sampling jokes in my article on this. And I then realized, that might not be the best because it might be a slightly different situation. Probably a different situation because there's a much more robust rights infrastructure. Yeah. Which than there is in art, which is, you know, mostly a money laundering scheme for people. But that's neither here nor there. All right.
Also, Tom Club, Genius of Love. That's the song I did a bad job of singing. So,
hey,
if it made anyone else wonder, what the hell is that? You know what it is.
Perfect. All right. Hey, I think that's everything. So we are going to chat with you later. You should be listening to this show, which you are, but you should be listening to it all the time. A thing that would be easier if you subscribed to it and gave it reviews, stars, write something. It all helps. You should listen to, I'm the guest on the Legal Tech Week Journalists Roundtable, talking about some legal tech. You should listen to the other shows on the Legal Talk Network. You should be reading Above the Law, as always, so you read these and other stories before we chat about them. You should be following us on social media. I'm at Joseph Patrice. He's at Writes for Rent, and Writes is the W, like he's physically writing Writes for Rent. You should follow Above the Law, which is at ATL Blog. I actually have moved. I've got a Blue Sky account, but I haven't really done much with it yet. But that's Joe Patrice, for whatever that's worth. You should be... What else? What else do I usually do here? Is that everything? Is that everybody I thank?
You make your plugs, you tell them to come back next week, and you know, we send them off.
Come on back next week. All right, we'll talk to you all later.
Peace.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.